The headlines, Russia turns off the gas tap to more European countries, cutting flows to Denmark and the Netherlands. China conducts a combat readiness patrol around Taiwan as the island state announces plans for military cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. And also, a Palestinian woman becomes the latest victim of Israeli gunfire in the West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russia widening its gas cuts to Europe. Denmark is the latest to see a halt in gas supply in response to its refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The Danish energy company says it has been reformed by Russia's energy giant Gazprom about its decision. That's the day after Gazprom turned off its supplies to the top Dutch trader. Denmark says, however, that it has stored enough gas and could buy more from the European market. Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland, citing their failure to make payments in rubles. Moscow's measure comes in response to a host of sanctions the European Union has imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine. On Monday, the bloc has agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and slash Russia's largest bank from the SWIFT system. The new sanctions sent Brent crude prices soaring to $122 a barrel. Former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett says that Europe will suffer more from the economic war it has launched against Russia. Take a listen.
Well, it comes down to substance. Russia has material. It has trees. It has oil. It has gas. It has gold. It has food. It has fertilizer. It has the substance of life. Europe has nothing but credit systems and banking systems, and really credit doesn't matter when you have a war situation. The only thing that matters is material substance. So Europe is basing all of its policy on the hot air and the fantasy that it is, it is essential. It is some sort of social hub that unites all of civilization, and it is not. Russia is faring far better than any other country. The ruble is at record highs. Half the world agrees with Russia. Only European countries do not. And that's really based on a vanity and a silly, soft, pacifist culture that has grown in Europe like a cancer because of the nanny state that the United States has imposed upon it. But if these countries are trying to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas, perhaps the best thing for Russia to do is to wean them off quickly by yanking the spigot out of their, out of their economies and letting them get to that place all the more faster. They really want to wean themselves off. Russia has no problem cutting them off tomorrow from every barrel of oil and every container of gas and sell it to China, sell it to India, sell it to South America, sell it to South Africa, sell it to other nations.
The U.S. president has confirmed that Washington will send more advanced rocket systems to Ukraine to strike what he said were key targets of Russian forces inside Ukraine. Joe Biden underlined in an op-ed article in the New York Times that the White House was neither encouraging nor enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. He said the U.S. was not seeking a war between NATO and Russia. He also noted that the United States is not trying to bring about the ouster of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He made it clear that Washington will not directly get engaged in the Russia-Ukraine conflict as long as the U.S. or its allies were not attacked. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be used to target and kill civilians.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbass people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted, and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women, and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance. In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
China has conducted a combat readiness sea and air patrols around Taiwan in response to what it calls collusion between the United States and the self-ruled island. In a statement, the Chinese military has criticized the U.S. for supporting Taiwanese forces, warning that such measures would push the island into a dangerous situation. The statement says the Chinese forces will strengthen their readiness to foil actions by those supporting Taiwan's independence. China's maneuver comes a day after the Taiwanese president acknowledged about plans for cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, but the U.S. has increased its military and diplomatic ties with Taipei. President Joe Biden also angered China recently after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if it's attacked by China. Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian woman in the occupied West Bank town of Al-Khalil. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli soldiers opened fire at 31-year-old Qufran Warasna at the entrance of the Al-Arub refugee camp. The Israeli military claims she was carrying a knife and approaching soldiers. The Red Crescent says the regime's forces prevented medics from reaching injured Warasna until after 20 minutes of the shooting. Israel has recently escalated its deadly attacks against Palestinians in the occupied territories. More than 20 Palestinians, including prominent journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, have been killed since March. Mona Kandil joined us earlier with an update on the Israeli shooting. She says the regime soldiers could have stopped the Palestinian woman if there was a threat, but they fatally shot her without remorse.
The Israeli military claims that Ghufran arrived at a semi-checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Arub refugee camp, and she was wielding a knife. This is the Israeli story. And just before she approached even the Israeli soldiers who were conducting, let's say, security a search in the area and in order to make sure that the roads are safety, because these roads are used by Israeli settlers, even if they are at the entrance to the Palestinian refugee camps and Palestinian towns. Immediately, one of the Israeli soldiers decided to shoot her with the live fire. According to the international law, and in case Israeli soldiers or any soldiers felt, threatened, they could use their fire to hinder the movement, let's say, so-called attacker. But in this case, they are claiming that she had a knife. They are claiming that she tried to approach them. And before even she arrived at the checkpoint, she opened fire at her to kill her, not to hinder her movement, to arrest her and question her to see if she was what she was going to do.
People in Gaza have protested to draw up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially administrative detainees. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A pro-Palestinian professor was forced out of his job at the University of Bristol after the pro-Israel lobby accused him of being anti-Semitic. He is vowing to continue advocating for Palestine. This after a new round of opposition emerged online attempting to silence him for speaking out. Amina Taylor sat down with David Miller for a one-on-one after the latest round of attacks.
A leading scholarly critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians is speaking out after renewed attacks surface regarding his anti-Zionism work. The social media firestorm erupted after Dr. David Miller shared snippets of an episode of Palestine Declassified, where he's a co-host and co-producer, where the controversial Chabad Lugovic set was profiled. The Community Security Trust led the latest charge against Dr. Miller, saying they needed to provide specialized anti-terror training as a result of the charges of extremism leveled against the group.
As some people will know watching this, the Community Security Trust has for a long time tried to attack me and was involved in me being sacked from the University of Bristol. And my response to them specifically was to say, well, they have in their charitable objectives of their charity that they should be educating people about extremism. So my view is that they should be educating the British public about extremist organisations like this one, regardless of whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Christian. But of course they don't and won't do that.
David Miller and his supporters are well aware that there's a coordinated campaign afoot, one that seeks to undermine and smear his name and reputation at every turn. But for Professor Miller, these attacks simply strengthen his resolve. These fresh attacks are the latest in a long line of smears that led to Professor Miller being removed from his post at the University of Bristol. A tribunal on the issue is slated to be held in 2023.
Those who speak up for Palestinian rights will be attacked by Zionist groups, Zionist lobbies, and it will be said that they are anti-Semitic. This is the weapon of choice which they use. But it's not only in the UK. There are numerous other examples in other countries, in Germany, in Austria, in France, in the US, in other countries too. That case, my case, other cases too, they are a sort of warning to other people. You know, don't do this. Don't speak up. Don't tell the truth as you see it, because this will happen to you. And, of course, that frightens many people. What's at stake is that you're not allowed to speak out about Palestine. And if you do, that they will come for you. And we see that. You've mentioned academics. Yes, it affects academics all across the country, but we also see it with other, in other areas. We see counsellors and popular music stars and a whole range of people being attacked.
Like others who've paid a high price for speaking out, Professor Miller refuses to be cowed and will continue fighting for justice for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Oxfam has urged all parties to the conflict in Yemen to extend the current armistice to help avert catastrophic hunger and prevent the humanitarian crisis spiraling in the country. The international charity organization says the truce has led to a drop in civilian casualties as airstrikes and ground fighting have significantly reduced. So Oxfam says the opportunity must be seized to extend the truce and push for a lasting peace. The international body sounded the alarm on Tuesday, a day before the UN-brokered ceasefire was expected to run out. A Saudi-led coalition began unleashing a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into a harrowing humanitarian crisis. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Birth anniversary of our innocent lady of Qom. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on a very blessed day that heralds the start of celebrations of another 10 days of spiritual munificence in the Islamic Republic of Iran, known as Dahe-e Keramat. Today, the first of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, is the birthday of a very virtuous lady whose munificence continues to benefit all visitors to her shrine even after the passing of over 1,000,002 centuries. For the information of our listeners, she's none other than Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, who reposes in eternal peace in the magnificent mausoleum in the city of Qom, which is a two-hour drive from Tehran and is second most important holy site of pilgrimage in Iran. The most blessed place in Iran is, of course, the grand holy shrine in Mashhad, Khorasan, of her illustrious brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, who was born on the 11th of Dhul-Qa'dah, that marks the end of Dahe-e Keramat. Please stay with us for a special feature on this auspicious day, which is celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran as the Day of Virtuous Daughters. Oh, Fatima, intercede for me for the reward of paradise, for indeed you have with Allah a lofty status. What we recited to you is the English translation of the famous Arabic phrase of ziyaratname, or standard form of salutation that is being recited today in the Holy Qom by devotees, returning into hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, if we take into account those reciting it from their homes all over the world while saluting this impeccable lady. Born in Holy Medina in 173 AH, corresponding to 789 AD, she was named Fatemeh, peace upon her, in honor of her great ancestress, the noblest lady of all times. Hazrat Fatemeh Zahra, peace upon her, the infallible daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. She was 10 years old when her loving father, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, was martyred through poisoning in the dungeon of Baghdad on the orders of the tyrant Harun al-Rashid, the self-styled caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime. She was renowned for her piety as well as for her knowledge and wisdom, to the extent many people, especially women, would approach her threshold to seek solutions to many a legal, religious, or social problem. She did not marry, since, like the Virgin Mary, peace upon her, the mother of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, no person of her times was deemed worthy of her hand. Hazrat Fatemeh Masume grew into an impeccably virtuous lady whose prodigious thirst for knowledge enabled her to answer questions posed by even gray-bearded scholars while still a child of less than 7 years. It would be repetitive to recount the incident of a group of Iranians who, after performing the Hajj pilgrimage in Mecca, had come to Medina to pay respects at the Prophet's shrine and also to visit the seventh Imam for clearing doubts regarding some jurisprudential matters. The Imam happened to be out of the city, and they had no time to wait for his return. To their surprise, however, a series of satisfactory answers was provided to them by a little girl from behind the curtain. When they chanced to meet the Imam on their way back to Iran and for further satisfaction showed him the answers they had received from his house, he exclaimed with a smile, "Fedaha Abuha," which means, "May her father be her sacrifice." Without the least doubt, the group of Iranians on reaching their homeland may have briefed their friends and families on the virtues of the little girl of the Prophet's household, who, unknown to them, was destined to find her permanent resting place over 20 years later, at the age of 29, in an obscure desert city in Iran, which would one day achieve global fame, with the scholars coming from all over the globe to acquire genuine knowledge about Islam. At the age of 28, she, along with several of her brothers, left Medina for distant Khorasan so as to reside near her eldest brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who had been forcibly taken to northeastern Iran by agents of the crafty caliph Ma'mun. During her long and arduous journey, her caravan was attacked by Abbasid agents near the city of Saveh, 128 kilometers west of modern Tehran. As a result, many of her fellow travelers were martyred, and she turned towards Qom, where, on hearing the news of her arrival, the elders of the city came out in large numbers to greet her and escorted her in respect.
some 17 days later, tired from the journey and shaken because of the attack on her caravan, the noble lady left for her heavenly abode, plunging the followers of the Ahlul Bayt in profound grief. They laid her to rest in an orchard that soon turned into a site of pilgrimage. And today, her grand mausoleum attracts pilgrims from all over the world to the city, which has turned into the leading center for diffusion of the genuine teachings of Islam throughout the globe. Many of the foreigners visiting her shrine in Qom have embraced the truth of Islam, and after acquiring Islamic sciences, have gone back to their countries as missionaries, spreading the dynamic message of the school of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. It is interesting to note that in 2010, a woman celebrity of the West who experienced enlightenment and became Muslim while sitting and contemplating in the holy mausoleum of Hazrat Masumeh, peace upon her, was Lauren Booth, the sister-in-law of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. A broadcaster, journalist, and activist, Lauren Booth fully observes the hijab while working as a freelance writer and media consultant in Britain. In 2012, she co-founded the UK charity Peace Trail. It was indeed divine providence at work, especially in view of the famous hadith of the Prophet, that of the 8 gateways to paradise, one opens through Qom. Without the least doubt, this particular gateway is none other than the sprawling golden-domed shrine of Fatemeh Masumeh, peace upon her, at whose doorstep, in accordance with Ayatul Wasila in the Noble Qur'an, true believers seek intercession with God Almighty, as is evident by the phrase mentioned at the beginning of this brief radio program. It also becomes clear to us why her grandfather, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, had, over half a century before her birth, said in explicit words that Qom is the haram, or sanctuary of us, the Ahlul Bayt. Her prime position in the stairway that leads to heaven could be gauged by the fact that of all the venerable ladies of the Prophet's progeny named Fatemeh, it is only Masumeh, peace upon her, who has such a grand mausoleum and whose intercession with God is so frequently sought day and night throughout the year. Of course, there is no lady superior to the noblest lady of all times, the Lady of Paradise, Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra, peace upon her. But since it was God's will that the Prophet's infallible daughter should be laid to rest in an unmarked grave at an unknown spot in Medina, where one day the godless Wahhabis would desecrate the graves of all godly persons, it is the shrine of Fatemeh Masumeh, peace upon her, that provides solace to the hearts of the true believers as the worthy substitute for her illustrious ancestress. No doubt her brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, and her nephew, Imam Javad, peace upon him, had said, "Whoever visits her tomb, aware of her exalted status, paradise is the reward."
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russian forces have launched multiple drone attacks against Ukrainian military targets in the Donetsk region. Meanwhile, fighting is raging on in Donbass's Severodonetsk. According to Ukrainian officials, Russian forces are in control of most of the city, and this while the Eurozone is beginning to feel the pinch of a new record inflation as a result of the war. Inflation is at multi-decade highs in several major European economies, including in Germany and France. It also remains persistently high in the United Kingdom and the United States. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, from Potsdam, Germany. Journalist and political analyst, Fred Ware, in Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me start with Harley. Given the recent military gains by Russian forces in Ukraine, as we just heard in the news, where do you expect this war to end up in?
Well, the question is whether the government of Ukraine will allow itself to continue to be used as a battering ram at the expense of its own population against Russia. The intent of the United States and NATO is regime change in Moscow. And they're going to do everything they can, as several spokesmen for the Biden administration have said, to bleed Russia with sanctions, with more weapons, and so on. Meanwhile, the idea that they're defending sovereignty and democracy in Ukraine is proving to be a complete joke. So I think what's going to happen is that the appetite in the West for continuing to provide weapons in a losing cause is going to have political blowback, especially, as you mentioned, with inflation, with economic problems, with the effects of the oil embargo that they're trying to pursue, and so on. So the real question is, how much longer will the Ukrainian forces hold out? And this is this has been, since the beginning of the war, the real issue.
Okay, let me ask, put the same question to Fred. Fred, where would this eventually end up in?
Well, right now we're in this phase where things are being decided on the battlefield. Mm. Neither side really is ready to go to a negotiating position. Both sides have some expectation of victory. I think on the Ukrainian side, it is being definitely finessed by their Western partners, especially the United States, which does seem to want to use Ukraine as a battering ram against Russia. The United States is trying to exploit this situation globally in a lot of ways to reestablish, as they see it, the unity, pro-Western, pro-American unity. And so we're not going to see a negotiated solution, which is really the only way out. The only way for this to end, and the sooner the better, is for them to come to some kind of realistic deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Harley, on Monday, the EU agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and to slash its bank system from the SWIFT system. And the sixth round of sanctions on Russia has sent Brent crude prices soaring. They're not, you know, it's now selling at $122 per barrel. So is Europe benefiting from the anti-Russia sanctions it's imposing this way, or losing?
Now, this is a suicidal lunacy for Europe. You know, here in Germany, we have a situation where gas prices, because of the taxes and the local situation, gas is becoming unaffordable for many working families. The inflation rate is soaring, and the inflation rate is not simply a result of the war. The West is trying to blame it on Putin, but the inflation was there before this started, and it's there because of the quantitative easing policy, the pumping of liquidity into a system which is not functioning. It's bankrupt. So the idea that somehow you're going to bring Moscow to terms by cutting the oil shipments, you know, Moscow has other partners, other countries that will buy the oil. The Europeans have no other place to get the energy they need. I think the idea of getting natural gas from the United States when you don't even have capabilities to store it in Germany, for example, is silliness. And the austerity that this is going to force, it's not just that it's going to raise prices, it's going to affect the ability of these economies to continue to run. The auto sector, the machine tool sector in Germany and France, also in Italy. So they're all feeling a pinch. And so the idea that this is somehow going to bring down Russia, which is what Ursula von der Leyen said when she announced this, is just silliness.
Right. Fred, what do you think? How far could these Western sanctions against Moscow go? Are they worth it?
I think that they can go further. But it's true that there's a tremendous amount of blowback. They're not well thought out. The idea was that they would just pile on all these sanctions at the beginning and Russia would crumble. Mm-hmm. That is not happening. I live in Moscow. I don't see any real change in my life as an average consumer. Okay, prices are up. There is inflation. Otherwise, grocery stores are well stocked. All the consumer services are in place. It's not hitting the average Russian. It's hitting maybe people like me who have Western connections. I bank in the West. I'm screwed in a lot of ways by Western sanctions. But I'm not the guy they were supposed to be aiming at. And in general, things like embargoing oil is going to raise the cost of oil, the price. It's going to jump again, which means that Russia can afford to sell less of it on world markets because it's a, you know, what do you call a fungible commodity? You can sell it here, you can turn it around and sell it there, and they'll just sell more there at higher prices. So I don't see how this hurts Russia. A lot of the sanctions backfire, especially on Europe. Not so much on the United States, which never had much in the way of economic relations with Russia, but in Europe, they are dismantling a lot of fundamental things that they need, and they're being disproportionately hurt, even more than Russia is, by this new sanctions regime.
Right. Now, Harley, in response to sanctions, Russia's Gazprom has turned off its supplies to Netherlands because it's refused to pay for its gas in rubles. Then also we have Denmark could also see a halt in its gas supplies. And as you know, Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland. So what should we be expecting at the end of the day?
Well, the question is, how long will the people of Europe sit by and watch their governments cut the economies that they live in? You know, this is... I think the report from Moscow is interesting because one of the other things about the Russian economy is it's not just oil. the view in the West among people like the CIA director in the United States, like the Biden team, Blinken, Sullivan, and others, is the Obama line, that Moscow is just a gas station pumping oil and gas. But Russia also exports almost 20% of, or more than 20% of the world's nickel, 19% of semi-finished iron. We know in terms of grain and fertilizer the importance of the Russian economy. So the more they cut off from Russia, the more damage will be done to the populations of Europe. Now, this, at a certain point, will have a price, because you have governments like the government in Germany is a very unstable coalition. Scholz, the chancellor, only got 26% in the election, and he's dependent on an alliance with the Greens and the Free Democrats. In France, Macron, if you figure the low turnout, Macron only had a quarter of the vote from the people who could have voted. So these are weak governments. They also have very different approaches to Russia. You had Macron and Scholz talking to Putin. Draghi from Italy was talking to Putin. They're all sort of trying to work certain angles. But the problem they have is they don't have a military solution. And that's what they're still trying to do, is cripple Russia militarily and financially. And I think the Russians are, their economy is strong enough and the military is strong enough to survive this. The question is Ukraine, or are the governments of Europe?
Okay. Now, Fred, Germany is trying to create this huge army, as they call it, within NATO in the midst of this Russia-Ukraine war. So in your opinion, what direction is NATO moving, and how do you anticipate the prospect of security in Europe?
I think that that's all an open question. Things are changing very fast. History is rushing back in a lot of ways. I understand that the view in Washington is to reinstate the old Cold War paradigm. And so far, there's an argument that European unity, especially NATO, are getting their mojo back. And, you know, Finland and Sweden want to join. But this is a different time, and the geopolitics are really very different and much more fragile. I can't say how things are going to go, mm-hmm. but fully rearmed Germany was not the thing that the post-war American perspective was for. I don't think that Europe is going to look all that favorably on a rearming Germany down the road. A lot of things are changing fast and in ways that we can't predict.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Harley, one basic question. NATO, maybe the raison d'etre for NATO being formed in the first place decades ago was to check Soviet Union and, you know, protect itself maybe from any likely threat. But what about now? What's NATO's mission these days? There is no more Soviet
Union. Well, it
depends
on who you ask. But if I may first just say one thing about what Fred was saying.
Sure, go ahead.
The problem that you have in Germany, and I just met today with some people on the Bundestag Finance Committee, they're trying to figure out how they can justify the huge increase in defense spending when they don't have money for infrastructure. The German rail system is in a state of breakdown. There are bridges collapsing in parts of Germany. Mm. And so if you put more money into war, you're taking it away from teachers. My son's school is cutting back in the number of teachers they have here in Potsdam. So it's a very fragile situation. And secondly, the rest of the world, the southern world, the former non-aligned nations, former colonial nations, are not in for this NATO-US ride. So that in itself is a very difficult thing. In terms of the way the US is looking at it, I agree they have this Cold War scenario, but their view is NATO should become a global enforcer. And this is the idea, the global Britain, for example, of Boris Johnson, includes a global NATO. And they're preparing now the next phase, which is to contain China. Now, this, for the American military, is a real challenge, because their whole view in the past has been, we can fight Russia or we can fight China, but not both. and they try to split the two. It's not going to work. Russia and China have primarily an economic alliance, but also a military alliance.
Okay.
Is the United States prepared to fight a two-front war when we had the fiasco in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on? So I think this idea of NATO as a global force is not going to function. And the British have another idea. Boris Johnson is talking about a new Commonwealth, which would unite Britain, Poland, Ukraine, and the Baltic states, and maybe bring in Turkey. But what we can see from Turkey is Erdogan is not so anxious to jump into this fire. So I think most of their planning is based on delusional views that, that Russia is weak and that Europe is united. And I think the unity of Europe is going to start cracking.
Okay, Fred, do you share the same views as Harley?
Well, not with the same certainty, but as I said, unpredictable times. We also have to watch Poland and Hungary. Mm. If Ukraine, the Ukrainian state, starts to fail, I think you will see, I think the groundwork is being laid for Polish intervention into the Western Ukraine, which used to be part of Poland. There's a long, long history there. And as I said, history is rushing back into the vacuums that are being created by this these really terrible events. I don't want to understate just how badly this war has shaken all everything we thought we knew about European security architecture. a lot of blame to go around for it, and it's not over yet. But I sit at the nexus of, you know, all the information streams and follow it obsessively, and I think people underestimate how destructive this war is, just the horrific casualties that are being experienced on both sides. Yeah. But Ukraine, the Ukrainian nation, is being undermined demographically, economically, and its statehood is, if this goes on, its very statehood is going to fall into question.
Okay, Harold, let me ask you about the U.S. Where is the U.S. in this? Has it achieved what it wanted to, or is it losing things? You know, Biden is just blaming, as he put it, 70% of the rising fuel prices in the U.S. on this Ukraine-Russia war.
Well, there was a Reuters poll the other day that said that 80% of the American people think the nation is going in the wrong direction. Now, here's an example. $40 billion was the new arms package that Biden got through the Congress with very little opposition from either party. Mm-hmm. And yet, American mothers can't get baby formula. American teachers are not getting paid. Hospitals are short-staffed. The infrastructure bill, which was supposed to be Biden's signature policy, is not being funded. So I think there's a great deal of anxiety in the population. Often you find, because of the anti-Russian sentiment in the American people, that can be ginned back up, at least initially, in the idea of a war. But the demonization of Putin is not quite the same as the old Soviet Union. And you may remember in 2016, Donald Trump won an election when he said he wants to end these endless wars and wants to be friends with Russia. Right. I think there's still some sentiment for that. And I think the American people have been through more than 20 years of wars. We just had Memorial Day where we celebrated or commemorated the casualties of America's wars. And since 2001, most of those casualties have been wars that should not have been fought. So I think the question in the United States, it's still to be determined. The problem is there's no real leadership pushing an anti-war position in either party. And that's why the population is not reacting more aggressively against it.
Mm-hmm. And Fred, one last question I want to put to both of you. Who do you believe is going to be the main loser of this Russia-Ukraine war? Who is benefiting most from it?
Well, if you're asking me, Ukraine is the big loser. I mean, it is, as I said, Ukraine is just taking such a terrible beating. and in so many ways. It's not just the Russians who are now gaining on the battlefield and really inflicting punishment. I mean, it's just terrible. It's on both sides. I mean, the Ukrainians are fighting well, don't get me wrong. They're fighting with quite a lot of spirit, and 8 years of NATO training is paying off for especially the regular army. But at the end of the day, the outflow of people from Ukraine, it was already hollowed out demographically before this war happened, and now millions of people have left, and many of them are never coming back. Men in a certain able-bodied age bracket are being severely injured or killed. This is devastating for Ukraine. It's not good for Russia either. Like, I have a lot of friends who are like very pro this operation. A lot of Russian friends who have gotten behind it for reasons I don't fully understand. But this is bad for Russia as well. I think that the big winner will be the United States, at least geopolitically. So far, they look like the ones whose industries are profiting enormously off of this. The reorientation of a lot of public money to military effort. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that the United States has spent now about $54 billion in the past 3 months given to Ukraine. I mean, it's not all delivered yet, but $54 billion is more than Russia's annual military budget. It's just a mind-boggling amount of money that's being pumped into Ukraine, but that's profiting mainly American industries and the Pentagon, and very little of it will be seen by average Ukrainians. So yeah, the United States is the big winner here so far.
Harley, big loser, big winner. We have 1 minute.
Well, I think I have great sympathy for the people of Ukraine, but I think the government of Ukraine has to take responsibility for that. I think the military-industrial complex is gaining in the United States, but I don't think it helps the United States. I think the United States is being seen around the world as a hypocrite, talking about democracy and freedom, while it's using the Ukrainian people as a battering ram and Ukraine as an aircraft carrier against Russia. So I think the U.S. image is going to be badly tarnished by this, just as it was by the Iraq War and the Afghan War.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this episode of The Spotlight. Thank you, my guest, spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, in Potsdam, Germany. Journalist and political analyst Fred Ware in Moscow.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وسئل عليه السلام عن الإيمان فقال الإيمان معرفة بالقلب وإقرار باللسان وعمل بالأركان.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam was asked about belief when he said, "Belief means appreciation with the heart, acknowledgement with the tongue, and action with the limbs."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, in this beautiful statements of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, he speaks about this organ or this part of the human body known as the heart. Now, of course, the heart being the center of the love for Allah, and it being the center where it is the abode of Allah, we find that this heart is something which needs to be protected. When the heart is perfected, and the soul is perfected, and the intellect is perfected, well, then that is how we reach salvation. Now, of course, trying to reach the ultimate perfection is something which is very difficult, and ultimately the ultimate perfection is Allah, and nobody can reach that level of perfection. But when we find that in human terms, the perfection of a human being, and the perfect human being, of course, was the Holy Prophet, and after him, the divinely appointed imams. The heart has a huge role to play. We find that along with their souls and their intellects, their hearts were also perfect and pure. And so along these lines, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he speaks about the heart, and he says that if the heart gains security and tranquility, it will be overtaken by vanity. Now, sometimes in our lives as Muslims, or even as non-Muslims, we ask this question as to, well, why do we have insecurity, or we have this turbulent, unstable times in our lives? Now, one of the solutions or one of the reasons can potentially be in this tradition, that if one has too much security and